For its April 8th, 1966 issue, Time magazine created one of the best known magazine covers ever. For the first time in that publication's history, there was simply text with no accompanying image. Framed by its iconic red border against an all-black background, a provocative question appeared in large red text. Is God dead? 51 years later, on April 3rd, 2017, just a few weeks ago, Time recreated the famous, infamous cover. Red border, all black background, but a different provocative question still in bold red type. Is truth dead? Nancy Gibbs, Time's editor, explained that the 1966 cover appeared at a time when 97% of the people in this country told pollsters they believed in God. Now, she said, I suspect that many would say they believe in truth, a word she curiously capitalized. And yet, she continued, we find ourselves in an intense debate over its role and power. She named the issue explicitly, whether it's the size of his inaugural crowds, or voter fraud, or NATO funding, or the claim that he was wiretapped. Trump says a great many things that are demonstrably false. Conservative columnist George Will was recently more scathing. He wrote of our prevaricating president, the problem isn't that he doesn't know this or that, or that he doesn't know that he doesn't know this or that. Rather, the dangerous thing is that he does not know what it is to know something. On a gray, chilly day in January, made all the drearier by the disaster that was transpiring, I stood on the inaugural route along with several thousand protesters, determined to show our dissent on day one. By some accounts, supported by photographic evidence and by experienced analysts, the overall crowd was considerably smaller than in some recent past inaugurations. By other accounts, supported by other accounts, we were part of an unprecedented, huge turnout. And now we know these other accounts were followed by the admission that figures believed to be true proved not to be true, but also by the now notorious new addition to the lexicon, alternative facts. It was our first glimpse post-inauguration of a man who, as George Will said, does not know what it means to know something. Sadly, it has recurred so often since that we're becoming a bit immune, almost expecting that no matter what is said or tweeted, it will almost certainly not be the truth. So while reports of the death of truth may be greatly exaggerated, People all along the political spectrum are painfully aware that truth has had an especially rough time of it these past few months. Truth is no small matter in our liberating religion. We name it right into the heart of one of our defining principles, affirming the deep value of, as we call it, a free and responsible search for truth. My friend and colleague Victoria Safford calls this the place of truth telling. And our colleague Paige Getty enshrines that emphasis. As a faith tradition, Unitarian Universalism makes sacred, she writes, the right and responsibility to engage in this free and responsible quest as a religious act. An act of religious devotion. For all that has imperiled truth in our time, we're not ready to concede its extinction, to grant that it is perfectly acceptable to suspend reason and claim as true whatever now suits our purposes. If truth really were dead, if there were no longer truth for which to search, our very religious identity would be undermined. And that should matter to the rest of the world, since we are, after all, the largest organized religion in the history of humankind. With somewhere between 6 and 8 billion members. Or so. Facts matter to us, even the ones that make us uncomfortable. Evidence counts for something here, even the case against how we might wish things were. Science has authority in our lives and is an aid in, not an impediment to, our religious understanding. Historical veracity is a critical component for us. From our very founding, we have declared that religion should not, in fact, religion cannot rewrite the course of reason. And so we take issue with things we recognize to be demonstrably false. But we all know it's not actually quite so straightforward. For example, science can, in fairly short order, explain the physiological processes at play when we see Sophie Tauper Arp's white and yellow slotted figure displayed before us on the screen right now. We can read clear and cogent explanations about light and rods and cones and brain signals and so on. All of that will be true. And it is a deeply valuable scientific truth. But how the Swiss artist's work makes us feel is not something science or history can give us. Are we stirred, inspired, confused, ambivalent? Does this particular work strike us as interesting or banal? Are we glad that it's a part of this service? Or annoyed that it is being projected into this space? Keep your votes to yourself. In ways we may recognize, and in ways we almost certainly will not be completely aware of, how we respond to this particular piece of art will be informed by our own personal experiences. Do we already know Tauper Arp's work and smile in recognition? Were we once dragged to museums and associate seeing art with boring afternoons in childhood? Did we have an art teacher in school who we adored? Or a former lover whose art snobbery made us feel inferior? Does being differently abled restrict our access to visual art and present a barrier to its enjoyment? Do we have no experience at all with this sort of art? And can't imagine why anyone would like it. Truth in this case becomes my truth, your truth, a kind of self-understanding accessible only by introspection, by taking the time to notice. And what may seem like a simple question, do you like this painting? Could have many layers of personal truth informing the response any one of us might offer. So it was when Alicia Chambers was asked, in the reading you heard a few moments ago, to write down her race. It turns out it's not easy or simple to respond. The truest answer she knows how to give is a story. Actually, some stories. Of a strong woman, a wise man, a brave woman, a lost man, of those colored like coffee, dark as chocolate, pale as snow, of music, of her great-grandmother, her grandfather, her mother, of books, and more music, and of a brother. The truth has many faces and many sounds for Alicia Chambers, whose great-grandparents I happen to know. And without taking the time to listen to her stories, we're left with a final answer, a certain kind of truth, other, that doesn't really tell us very much at all. Years ago, in the dining room of the small international school where I was studying, two Nigerian students stood up on October 1st and began offering a celebration of Nigerian Independence Day. They played music, they sang, and then they started telling the story of how the bold Nigerians won their independence. After a few minutes, another student from Putney outside London shouted out, "You didn't win your independence, we gave it to you." And what ensued was a fierce war of words, spoken with heated passion out of each of their experience. The son of the colonizers, aggrandizing the generosity of the empire. The sons of the colonized, angry all over again. It is a Nigerian writer, the gifted and the flawed, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who warns, the single story creates stereotypes. And the problem with stereotypes is not that they are untrue, but that they are incomplete. That makes one story the only story. Just 2 weeks ago, my friend Leon Spencer stood in this pulpit in his role as one of the three interim presidents for our Unitarian Universalist Association. He spoke of our challenges and of our promise. But then he turned somber and very, very quiet. As he recounted a past experience in this very room, leading a meeting when he was head of our district. Leon, one of the very few African American leaders in our faith, helped organize the effort to try to get our name changed. For years, we had been the Thomas Jefferson District. Thomas Jefferson. As we in the dominant culture told the story, a man of reason, of remarkable intellect, remarkable influence, a prolific writer who professed his identity with early Unitarianism. What's not to like about that story? But Leon, 2 weeks ago in this pulpit, fought his emotion as he recounted the bitterness of the defeat when we voted to retain the name of Jefferson. Because he not only knew another story, he felt another story. The story of Jefferson, the enslaver. Jefferson, the rapist. Jefferson, the man who would not free his own children, progeny from a woman over whom he claimed ownership. How, Leon wondered, how could people professing our values aggrandize the story of Jefferson? Enshrine his name in our contemporary work. There were, as Nikki Finney says, there were two different truths. Both were true, the honorable and the horrific. One has served as a dominant story for a very long time. A story by Leon's account that is at the very heart of our culture of white supremacy. Oh, now we're talking about a whole different kind of truth. Right. The truth, the story some hold dear and some feel holds them back or shuts them out. The truth, the story some are now shouting in our streets and others are responding often before ever even really listening. How could they possibly say that? The truth, the story that has been dominant and defining and is so much a part of who we are that many of us are absolutely oblivious to it. My colleague Fred Small wrote words a few years ago that are more relevant now than they were then. Our fourth principle, he writes, affirms a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. We must ask, whose truth? The truth of victors who write the history books and make the laws and for whom the spoils of war have become a legacy and a birthright? Or the truth of the vanquished, the dispossessed, the refugee? Mary Oliver commends, "Let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers." Ah, so much easier when those are someplace else. So much easier when it is another who is so transparently guilty of shaping reality to suit his own whims. But what about when it is us? What if we're the ones often obliviously telling one dominant story and thinking we have the answers? In his account of a week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, Henry David Thoreau observes, "It takes two to speak the truth. One to speak and the other to listen." Maybe the time has come for those of us most closely aligned with the dominant culture. Men, straight people, those comfortable with a gender binary, homeowners, those with an education, those without a record, maybe especially those of us who are beneficiaries of the dominant, dominating culture. Maybe in the name of the search for real truth and much deeper spiritual meaning, maybe it is time for us to listen. To listen so we can honestly hear how old truths can become oppressive truths. To listen so that we may honestly hear how new truths can assure that in very new ways and in very new forms, truth will live on. May it be so. May it be so.